This year is, of course, the 50th anniversary year of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, who is still regarded as one of the most popular and notable presidents in U.S. history. To commemorate the man and his time in office, the newspaper of record has authorized a book, The Kennedy Years, from the pages of the New York Times. It's edited by presidential historian Richard Reeves, with a foreword by the paper's executive editor, Jill Abramson. It's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Reeves to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to be there.
You, of course, are a senior lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC, and, of course, were a chief political correspondent for the New York Times from 1968 to 1971, and have written about Kennedy in great depth. What led you to this project?
Well, a phone call in which they asked me. They were doing it with Abrams Publishing, the art house, and I had done some work for Abrams in the past, and somehow between that and the fact that I come from the Times, they asked me if I would do this, and I did, and it was, it was kind of nice. The Times is a big part of my life, and I got to work with people I had worked with years ago. So, and then the material itself was just fantastic. I mean, if journalism is the first draft of history, as they say, this is really a good first draft. The coverage of the Times by people from James Reston to Russ Baker to Tom Wicker, they were the cream of the crop when Kennedy was president. I actually was still in college, but so it was a pleasure not so much to work with them, but to work with their thoughts and their ideas and their words, including, you know, people like David Halberstam, who is of my generation but isn't here anymore, unfortunately.
And wrote such beautiful and incredible coverage on the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
You,
which, of course, you know, I happen to be one. You mentioned earlier, I wrote my Kennedy book, Profiles in Power, in 19, well, I wrote it in the late 80s and early 90s. It came out in 1993.
Right.
And so we all, you know, that generation all went on to do different kinds of things. The world was different than in our business, journalism, then. Today, everybody, you know, is a multi-platform star. But we then, because the Times was a very rigid institution in those days, we gave the Times everything we had. We couldn't go on television without their permission. We couldn't write books. We couldn't. That's why most of us left, by the way. But but it was a tremendous collection of talent there.
In the introduction, you talk about, and I just want to touch on this, because you mention Profile in Power, and the book comes out in early 1993, and as you say, that even though it remains in print, obviously there is a lot of new information about the president that has come out since the publication of that book, much of which, you note, is unflattering.
Yes, most of it, I think. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but, you know, there must be 1,000 books more on Kennedy. And what got me into this mix was that I wanted to, I had read a biography of Haile Selassie, the Emperor of Ethiopia, a marvelous book by a Polish writer named Richard Kaczynski. And it was really the best I've ever read about what a leader did, and a pretty bizarre one at that. And I thought, you know, I didn't know anything about Ethiopia or about emperors, but I did know about presidents. And I, from reading that, I thought, I could do a book about what it's like being president. I know where the records are. I know where the witnesses are. And I had been there. And I decided on Kennedy, not because I was a great Kennedy file, although I traveled with Bobby Kennedy when I was at the Times, but the fact that no real books like Sorensen's and Schlesinger's original books, Kennedy and 1,000 Days, they really blocked the market, so that most of those hundreds of books that came out all the time, and I think 100 are coming out on this anniversary, 100 more, worked in the seams. That is, they were about sex and scandal, And that wasn't, to me, the real story. I mean, no heavy hitters came in for 25 years. And so I thought there was I sound like a football coach, but I thought there was an opening there, and that proved to be true.
You write in the introduction that ultimately Kennedy, by the end of his days, did have at least three historic achievements. One, of course, is the Cuban Missile Crisis and avoiding and preventing possible nuclear World War III. Also, his work on civil rights and his role and the push for the space race. So looking at those and reading...
And the nuclear test ban, which is part of the first.
Right. And reading the coverage of those stories in this book is fascinating, how it all unfolded in what is 1,000 days, in such a short period of time.
Yeah. Well, the book is, as you say, the book is real time. I mean, this is what these guys did, and this is what Kennedy read the first thing every morning. He used to work in bed. He read about 8 newspapers, the first being the New York Times, so that all of the pieces that are collected here were the first thing he read every morning of his presidency.
And
of course, there was a back and forth. I mean, the Times wasn't always on the same side as Kennedy. And Kennedy, who had worked, his only non-governmental job, really, was a brief stint as a reporter for Hearst in the mid-40s after the war. So he understood reporters. He understood reporters better than they understood him, I think, and knew how to use the press, and the press and television were what made him president.
Talk a little
bit. And his own family money and connections.
Talk a little bit about his relationship with the press and the media as a whole, and specifically the reporters of the New York Times, as you noted earlier, some of the best in the business.
Well, his relationship with the press, he defined to his own staff, which was, and many of his best friends were journalists, Ben Bradley, Charlie Bartlett, but he told his staff, you know, you've always got to remember that as much as we get along with these guys, after all, these guys were all veterans of World War II, they were close to his age, and he says, no matter how well we get along with them, you got to understand, in the end, they have a different agenda than we do. And that's true. We do have a different agenda than a president does. And in many instances, that makes it pretty unpleasant to be president when you pick up a paper in the morning, or today when you go to Politico.com or Real Clear Politics or whatnot. We're in a different business. But we all kind of like each other because the two businesses get along, particularly political writers and the politicians of those days. They were in many ways each other's good friends, even if they did have different agendas.
But there was an accessibility that is unheard of today.
Yeah. Yes. It was considered that the press, in fact, was necessary, that it was a necessary part of a democracy. And it was much smaller in those days when Ted Sorensen was still alive and I was interviewing him for my book, and we'd known each other for a long time. George H.W. Bush was president, and Ted and I sat there and laid out what his tasks were at the White House, and then we went to the Bush White House, and the jobs he held were divided among 123 people, so that this explosion of both government and press was bound to affect how close people could get to each other. And then, of course, after the assassination and new worries about security, everything changed, and the press was pushed away, more like the way it is now. But now we didn't have, almost all these guys were veterans of World War II, and that unified them. Kennedy's first political slogan was "The new generation offers a leader," and that was exactly right. It was a generational takeover from the commanding general, President Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, to a naval lieutenant. So that we had a generational change, and the press and the veterans and the Kennedy administration kind of all were part of the takeover generation.
Richard Reeves is our guest. He is the editor of the new book, The Kennedy Years, from the pages of the New York Times. You quoted, you were talking about Charlie Bartlett a moment ago, the columnist, and he's quoted in your introduction as saying, no one ever knew John Kennedy, not all of him, and you say that that's the way he ultimately wanted it. How was he able to make that a reality?
Well, what helps a lot, two things. One is that the rich people have long driveways. You can't kind of hang outside their house and get pictures of them or talk to them. And he had grown up in the world of wealth and sophistication. But he had also grown up with his own style in that complicated family, which he, when Eisenhower was president, and most presidents before him, they organized the White House in a corporate or a military way. It really was a pyramid. The president only dealt with a few people, then they dealt with each other, and then it would go down to the point where it reached the citizenry. Kennedy, deliberately, because he wanted things the way Charlie said they were, his White House was organized like spokes on a wagon wheel. And he was the hub in the center, and everybody reported down the spokes to him. Everything went through him, and the other spokes, the other people in whatever their jobs, government or Senator Johnson, they didn't know what the others were saying to Kennedy. Kennedy was the only one who knew everything that was happening, and the presidency was just one part of his life. He was also a husband, a father, and leader of the party, head of state, and all of those things. And he was, Robert Kennedy, as close as he was to his brother in some ways, was never invited to a family dinner in the White House. That was more or less reserved for other advisors, and it would drive Bobby nuts. He didn't know what happened. And if Bobby met alone with the president, the rest of them didn't know what happened either. And the president was the center, and he lived life there forward, and as kind of a race against boredom. He always thought he would die young, so he was a self-selected candidate. He would not have gotten the nomination under the old ways. And as president, he maintained that many sides of his life that no one knew about. We know more about them now, particularly about his health, but we didn't know then.
You write that he was an exceptional professional politician, charming and intelligent, detached and curious, candid, if not always honest. He could be ruthless when he thought it was necessary. And this is the line that I wanted to talk to you about. He was dangerously disorganized. How so?
He was patient, which is one of the things that served him well in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But he had a very short attention span, really. He knew a lot of history, but he lived life day to day as if every day was going to be the last one. And because only he knew everything that was happening, he was a pretty disorganized fellow. He'd read stuff in the papers and in the morning, and that in many ways would regulate his day. Tomorrow would be another day, and he might show a different facet of his personality and his leadership at that time. And, of course, he was a professional politician, and he didn't tell the truth. None of them do. They can't, for Obama is seeing right now. But he was more comfortable in that than most. He would keep us away. I'm saying us, the press, even though I wasn't there. With candor, he'd say very candid things, like about what he thought about Lyndon Johnson or the Queen of England or whatever, and those things would never reach print, but they would give the impression, to the press at least, that this was a guy who was letting it all hang out, and he wasn't letting anything hang out.
It's fascinating. I mean, you don't know how much of it is tinged by what we know about the story and how it ends, of course. But in reading the early coverage, especially during the campaign, it seemed even in the Times coverage that there was almost an understanding, and it was something that was a given, that this was somebody young, special, and different.
Yes. Because of that generation gap, and because all these guys came back, Ben Bradley once told me that he spent the war as an exec officer on a destroyer with the Imperial Japanese Army trying to get at those ships, trying to kill, as Ben said, trying to kill Ben Bradley. The war ends, they come home, and guys like Bradley are offered junior clerkships at various companies or papers or whatnot. And they wanted to get back to the action. And the action, when they got home, was controlled by old men, and they were determined to take it over. And they did. And Kennedy was the leader of that.
When you were going through this, what struck you about the coverage and about the reporting of that time that perhaps is different in the way that we cover and report on administrations now?
Well, the coverage then was much less casual than it is now. And Washington was a pretty closed shop in those days. And Kennedy made a move which changed the press and the country forever, in that it became very clear early on that all the good news, by Kennedy's orders, was going to be released by the White House. That the White House was going to be the center both of government and of press, and a lot of reporters who had been covering the Agriculture Department, the Defense Department, the what amounted to Health and Human Services, those agencies used to be covered, agriculture, by reporters. In the Kennedy administration, when there were only a couple of hundred White House correspondents, the press got the fact that the White House was going to be the center of action, Kennedy was going to be the center of action, and so they all gravitated away from the agencies in Congress and to the White House, which is exactly what Kennedy wanted. He wanted to control the flow of information, and he did a pretty good job of doing that. And so that there is, and reporters, it's amazing, someone like me who came along later, that guys like Scotty Reston, James Reston, who was the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, and others, talked to Kennedy all the time. And I knew from their notes and Kennedy's notes and archives what had happened with those conversations. But if you then go to the papers, the stuff in those conversations is rarely got to the press. The press covered government as government. It was only toward the end of the Kennedy administration they began to personalize it and go more into narrative journalism, which now rules the field, really, if Twitter doesn't.
Well, the name of the book is The Kennedy Years, from the pages of the New York Times. There's a foreword by Jill Abramson. It is edited by Richard Reeves. Richard, thank you so much for spending time with us. I greatly appreciate your time and your insight.
Thank you. Everything's okay up there?
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
I spent a lot of my youth there.
In Albany?
Yeah. I was in the Albany bureau, both the Herald Tribune and the New York Times, after the Tribune folded.
Oh, that's
great. I remember those days very well. Albany was a long way away. Now, you know, now it's not, and you've got Gillibrand in there for you, too.
Well, I thank you very much for spending the time and talking to us. I appreciate it.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Bye. Again, the name of the book is The Kennedy Years, from the pages of the New York Times. It's edited by Richard Reeves. It's published by Abrams. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.